This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan. Thanks so much for giving us a listen. This is the show about the most amazing, epic and deadly things that are around in the universe. Today we've got a little bit of an invention theme going on. A bit later we'll talk about one of the fastest planes ever made. Also, we'll chat about the invention of life itself. In a sec, we'll talk as well to the chief engineer of Crossrail, which is one of the biggest projects of engineering ever undertaken in the whole of history. We've got a dangerous Dan as well. It's a good one today as well. Really terrifying. It's not a dangerous place, an animal, even a disease. It's a dangerous job. You need to hear that. It will scare you out of your wits what these guys do, I promise. First, let's chat and catch up with an actual inventor on the show. He's Sir Sidney McSprocket. And he looks into the scientific brilliance of everyday items. Today, it's all about keeping things warm.
So Sidney McSprocket's Everyday Items, with the support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition.
Oh, hello. It's lovely to see you back. I'm just making the final adjustment to a very special invention of mine. A splint for limp chimps, no less. Now, you like this? Oh, now that wasn't supposed to happen. Never mind, more important matters at hand today. I'm off to town for a spot of shopping and have been preparing a packed lunch to pop in my bag. It wouldn't do to have a rumbly-tumbly distracting me now, would it? See, even my tummy agrees. Just adding a lovely hot flask of tea to my packed lunch. I've made the tea and it's piping hot. Now, where's my thermos flask? Have you seen it anywhere? You do know what a thermos flask is, don't you? Well, it's a very handy everyday item. It's a special bottle that keeps hot drink hot and cold drinks cold. A positive boon for all manner of outings, like picnics or shopping excursions. Oh, botheration. I just can't find it anywhere. Now, I have plenty of bottles here. Plastic pop bottles, glass jam jars, but they wouldn't be any good to carry me drink. The tea would go all cold, and it would be quite a challenge drinking out of a jam jar. China cups and saucers are normally how I like to enjoy a cup of tea, but they'd just get broken in my bag. Oh, there's my thermos flask. One of the handy things about thermos flasks is that they often come with a wee cup on top. Just the job for my shopping trip. Whilst I get my tea into the flask, let's load up the patented future scrutineer to tell us more about this handy invention. You works up a sweat, I can tell you.
The proper name for a thermos flask is actually a vacuum flask. It's an insulating storage vessel which keeps its contents hotter or cooler than its surroundings.
Aye, so it's not just handy for hot tea. It would keep your slushy ice drink chilly too.
The first vacuum flask was invented by Sir James Dewar in 1892. Not for drinks, but for his scientific experiments. In fact, they became very popular in scientific circles.
And back then, it was known as a Dewar flask.
The secret to how the vacuum flask works is that it is actually two flasks, one inside the other. Normally, there would be air between the two layers, but most of it is removed. Now, a space without air is called a vacuum, and heat can't travel through a vacuum.
So, the heat in my tea can't get out, and the heat outside can't get in to warm up cold drinks. Like all the best inventions, it's based on a very simple idea. In this case, stopping heat from getting somewhere where it's not needed.
In 1904, another inventor called Reinhold Berger realized that the vacuum flask wasn't just handy for scientists, but could be used by everyday people. He coined the term thermos and began the process for these handy flasks to become available to everyone.
He even had a catchy wee slogan. Keeps it cold, keeps it hot. Ice or fire needs it not.
Today, thermos flasks are found in many homes, and the same technology is used in science labs, factories, and hospitals. Even in space.
And now I've filled my thermos with piping hot tea. It won't get cold on my expedition to find a birthday present for my wee niece Denise from Dumfries. She's after a balloon that plays a tune, you see. It could be some time. Gawk, will you look at that? Talking of the time, it's tea cake o'clock. But that'll have to wait. I'm off to town to finish my shopping. Tatty bye for now, everyone.
So Sydney McSprocket's everyday items with the support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition.
There are loads more everyday items filled with inventing brilliance that you can catch up on. We've got loads of Sir Sidney McSprocket episodes online on the Fun Kids app, on iTunes, and over at funkidslive.com. We'll chat to Chris Binns, the chief engineer of Crossrail, in just a sec. Now, the Fun Kids Science Weekly actually is filled with loads of people just like Chris, you know, the smartest brains around that have undertaken some really important missions to help people out. And with that in mind, I've got a mission for you. It's vital right now. What I need you to do is to take out your phone or your tablet, to find the Fun Kids Science Weekly in the iTunes podcast store, and then when you found it, it's the key part of your assignment, your mission. You need to leave us a review. Write some words about the show, drop some stars in there as well, and the most important part is to leave your name. Then I will know if you've been successful on this mission. And next week, I might reward you for your assignment's completion with a shout-out. It's dead easy. You can't go wrong. See how you get on, though. Open up the iTunes podcast store, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, and leave us a review. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, our guest this week has helped oversee one of the biggest engineering projects that the world has ever known. It is Chris Binns from Crossrail. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. I think we'll start at the very beginning, then. Just kind of explain, Crossrail seems to have been in the news for years upon years. Tell us more about what it actually is.
Right, so Crossrail is the cross-London link that runs from east to west. It's a brand new line, railway line being dug and fitted out now, and it will run in the end from Reading to Shenfield and down to Abbey Wood in Kent. So it is about 42 kilometres of new tunnels under London and 10 new stations. And then it will interconnect with the existing network, which will bring together about 40 stations in all.
So it's this huge feat of engineering. And as I say, it's been going on for quite a while. What happened, though, on the very first day that you started digging? Where did you build? Where did you begin that first hole?
So the first hole started now it's about over five years ago. So May 2012, the first tunnelling machine started tunnelling, and that was in May 2012. And we've, over the last few years, we've had eight of those 1,000-tonne tunnelling machines, and they've now bored through 26 miles or 42 kilometres of just over 6-metre diameter rail tunnels.
So you say you've got eight of these giant diggers that have kind of carved the way out under the ground. Like, logistically, how much did you have to think about how they're working, how you're getting them underneath there so they can kind of dig out a route for us? How tricky was that?
Yeah, so that was really the main issue, in fact, is the logistics of just how you get all of the earth that they're digging out. And, in fact, one of the things we had specifically was a whole fleet of ships. We had five ships which were dedicated to transporting away the muck from those machines. In total, they dug out 3.4 million tonnes of material and... a total of 7 million tonnes of material, and a whole bunch of it, about 3 million tonnes of it, went out by ship and went to Wallasey Island. So it's actually raised the land in Wallasey Island in Essex, and that's now a nature reserve for wading birds. which has raised the level of the land to create marshland for the birds to use. So absolutely huge logistical challenge getting all the material out of London and away, and the ships were part of that.
Now, is it as simple as chucking a big digger down under London and driving it in a straight line and letting it dig through the earth? Or is there kind of a bit more to that? I can't really get my head around actually what goes on underground.
No, you're absolutely right. A huge amount of obstacles underground. So there's existing underground lines, there's sewers, there's tunnels with cables in, and then there's the foundations of buildings themselves. So if you have a building, you know, like a skyscraper, for example, big office block, there's building foundations which go down a long way underground. So, in fact, the machines are almost never on a straight line. And, in fact, the railway we've created is not going to be in a straight line. It's now got all the track fitted in these tunnels now. And when you go on it, it's actually always curving. It's curving to avoid obstacles, and it's going up and down as well as side to side. There was one bit in particular around Tottenham Court Road, which we called threading the eye of the needle, where the machines had to go in between various different tunnels, underground tunnels and utility tunnels and sewers and so on. And there was only about a metre to spare on each side as it cut through in that area. So the railway's at all different levels. It comes out of the ground just to the west of Paddington, comes out of the ground on the east side near Stratford at a place called Pudding Mill Lane, and it comes out at a place called Plumstead on the way down towards Kent. So we're at ground level there, and then the deepest point is 42 metres underground, which is at Finsbury Circus, just near Liverpool Street Station in the middle of London.
Now, even though it was very careful planning, were there any unexpected surprises en route when you were digging under London? Anything that you didn't think would be there that you found?
Nothing in particular. The machines do encounter soft spots and springs and things like that, but they're designed to cater for those. So, you know, we had times when we dug at a slower rate and times when we went at a faster rate. So the number of metres we bored on the fastest day of tunnelling was actually 72 metres, which was the record was set on the 16th of April 2014. And that was between Pudding Mill Lane and Stepney Green, and that was a machine that we'd called Ellie. In fact, each of the machines had names, and they were named after various people. The one that was last to finish was called Victoria, named after Queen Victoria, and that one finished on the 26th of May of 2015. So that was a couple of years back now.
Right, I want to know more about the machines, about Victoria, about Ellie. I know that they were all under there, that they were working really hard to clear all those millions of tons of land, which are then put on the island in Essex. Tell me more about the diggers, about the machines. What did they look like?
Okay, so they are huge machines. They're about 1,000 tons in weight each. So you can imagine really, really big machines. They're also very long. And so they have a cutting head at the front end. And then they extend backwards with conveyor belts that move the earth that they're digging out through to the back. So each machine weighed about the same as, if you imagine, 900 small cars, or another way of thinking about it, 200 African elephants. So that's the weight of each machine, absolutely massive machines. And they dig their way through the soil. The soil is removed out the through the back, out on the conveyor belts. And then inside the machine, the concrete tunnel segments, because as you dig out through the ground, you then have to line the tunnel to stop it collapsing behind. And so 200,000 concrete tunnel segments have been aligned. Each tunnel segment's 3.4 tons in weight, and each one comes in and they're built in a ring behind the machine. As the machine moves forward, it completes each ring and then pushes itself forward to put another ring behind it. And it's those concrete rings that now form the casing of the tunnel that hold back the earth and allow us to safely put the railway in, as we are nearly finished doing now.
Now, you know, in the US Marines, right, in the Navy over there, when you've got, like, SAS crew and the Marines, when they've done a really big job, they immediately retire straight away. They do one, like, huge mission, and then it's done. Are these diggers that have built Crossrail, are they still in action? Are they still working?
No, they've all either been dismantled or tunneled off to the side. So most of them were dismantled so that their expensive parts were returned to the manufacturer and then recycled for future tunneling projects. So that's things like the main bearings and the motors and things like that. The cutter heads, though, very often were cut into small bits and removed out of a shaft. And then there were a couple where we actually had to drive the machines to the side and bury them. So we reuse as much as we can because obviously they're very expensive machines and the parts go off to other projects. But there were a couple that had to be buried and covered over and are buried in the ground.
Brilliant. When can I ride it the first day? When's it open?
So Crossrail opens December next year, December 2018. So that's the first time that passenger trains will be available for the public. But we're starting testing later this year, 2017, with the first train coming down into the tunnel in the next month or so.
Brilliant. I'm excited to see how it goes. Chris, thank you so much for talking all things Crossrail on the Fun Kid Science Weekly.
That's great. You're welcome.
It is time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we look at the most deadly and terrifying things in the universe. And today, it's not a place, an animal, or a disease. It's a job. Because the United States Air Force, they run a squadron called the Hurricane Hunters. And these pilots, they do exactly that, right? On specially designed planes, the 53rd Weather Reconnaissance Squadron fly into hurricanes to gather data about loads of storms. All sorts about them too. Where the storms are, how fast they're moving, where they're heading as well. Now the team is given tips from a weather base on land. They tell them where the storms are likely to be headed all around the world. Usually they're overseas, right? This is where fierce winds whip up energy from the water and they turn them into sinister swirling storms. And the Hurricane Hunters, very simply, have to fly straight into them. Now a few weeks ago on the Fun Kid Science Weekly, you might remember we chatted to a hurricane expert who works at the Met Office. Now you can catch up on this episode online or on the free Fun Kids app. She told us that these typhoons made of swirling winds, diving, driving rain, and thunder and lightning. And they're so hugely dangerous to everybody. And this means that being a hurricane hunter is one of the most deadly jobs in the world. In fact, get this, over the last 60 years, 53 people have been killed searching for storms. So now the planes, they're mostly flown by naval units, who are the only people skilled enough to hunt for hurricanes. We'll get one of the science questions that you've sent to my page over at funkidslive.com answered by our expert Tom in just a sec. First, we need to catch up with Harry and Terry. They're the best mates. They were queuing for hot dogs, you know, wondering how bad the calories were going to be on their hips when something much more dangerous happened because they were sucked up into space. Now they are the space cadets, and they've got no chance of going home because they're having too much fun on Venus.
Welcome along to the astro adventures of the Space Cadets.
Breakfast time.
Woo!
You two have already had breakfast this morning.
Oh. Lunchtime.
Woo!
No, it's not lunchtime yet.
Oh. Brunch time then.
Fine, you can have brunch, but if I find crisp crumbs in the spaceship controls again, there will be big trouble.
Oh, sorry.
So where are we off to today, Zingy? There can't be many other planets left in the solar system, can there?
Oh, there's still lots left. Our solar system has 8 planets and 5 dwarf planets in total. The planets are Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune.
And all those planets orbit the Sun?
Yes, that's right. Right, boys, we have another message from Mission Control. They want you to go and explore the landscape of Venus.
Oh, I've heard of Venus. That's one of the ones you can see from Earth at night time.
Yes, that's right. It's the one that looks like the brightest star in the sky, but it's actually a planet, and that's where we're going now. Hold tight, off we go.
Oh, there's Venus, Terry. Wow. It looks about the same size as Earth.
Yes, Venus is very similar in size and mass to Earth. In fact, sometimes it's called Earth's twin.
Doesn't look very friendly down there, does it? Looks much hotter than Earth, and those clouds look a lot thicker.
It's like Earth's evil twin.
High five.
Indeed. Venus has an incredibly thick and toxic atmosphere of carbon dioxide. With an atmosphere like this, heat from the sun is trapped on the planet's surface. This greenhouse effect makes the surface 460 degrees. That's far hotter than any other planet in the solar system.
Can we get out and explore?
Well, you'll have to take the investigation pod. You can drive around the surface of Venus in it, and it will give you a supply of oxygen and help protect you from the immense heat. It'll be too hot for RoboWoof, though.
Sorry, boy. Oh, he really wants to come with us.
Sorry, boy. How long until it gets dark, Zingy?
Well, Venus rotates incredibly slowly, so daylight lasts for over 100 days. It also rotates in the opposite direction to Earth, so the sun appears to rise in the west.
Oh, so we've got ages. Pack a picnic, Terry.
The pod won't resist the intense heat for long. No time for a picnic, I'm afraid.
Oh, it'll be fine. I went on holiday to Spain last summer. It can't be much hotter than that. Oh, I take that back. This is hotter than Spain.
Whoa, this is even hotter than one of your dad's special curries.
Whee! This thing goes really fast. Whee!
Ah, Harry, watch out! You almost drove into that massive crater. Go the other way.
I saw it. What crater?
The one in front of us! Steer! What's that? It's RoboWoof.
Hello, boy. Did you stow yourself away?
Okay, RoboWoof. Be careful, okay? We're very near the edge of that crater. It looks a long way down. I can't even see the bottom.
No, boy, down. RoboWoof, get off the controls. Ah, help me steer, Terry.
Phew. See, even RoboWoof saw you needed help with your driving. These craters are massive.
I don't like Venus very much.
Whoa, look over there, guys. They look like massive volcanoes.
I hope they're not going to go off anytime soon.
What's that rumbling? Is that a volcano?
Oh, no, sorry. That's my stomach.
Was that you too, Harry?
No. I don't like this. Let's get out of here.
What was that, Zingy? That sounded like lightning.
Yes, lightning has been observed before on Venus. It's thought that it's caused by the toxic sulfur in the atmosphere.
You didn't warn us about that, Zingy.
Well, the lightning's only in the top of Venus's atmosphere. It wouldn't have hurt you. Now, did you discover anything else about Venus while you were out there?
Yeah, it's full of scary volcanoes, massive craters, and surprise robot dogs.
Interesting. It's likely that those craters would have been made by asteroids over millions of years.
Harry nearly drove into one.
Did not.
You so did.
All right, you two. Now, I'll send Mission Control the information about the surface of Venus.
Make sure you include not child or dog friendly. I know, there wasn't even a cafe down there.
Join us next time for more Astro Adventures with the Space Cadets.
There's loads of Space Cadets adventures that you can catch up on for free on your phone or tablet. Just get to iTunes, open up the free Fun Kids app, or you can have a listen over at funkidslive.com. It is expert Tom time on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Every week he answers one of the questions that you have sent to my page on the Fun Kids website. And I promise, right, as long as it's about science, it doesn't really matter what it is. Could be as silly or serious as you fancy. Maybe you want to know why you can't stand the taste of Brussels sprouts at Christmas, but every now and then you crave the chewy bitterness of a bogey from your nose. Really doesn't matter. If you send it to funkidslive.com, we'll get our expert Tom to answer it. Today's question comes from Cynthia, who is 11, who asks... Now, Cynthia says, to start off, straight off the bat, she says she's not very good at science, but she wants to know what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, the fact that Cynthia's asking that question makes me think she actually is good at science, because a lot of science is asking questions. I used to think that was one of the unanswerable ones, because we usually say that. But actually, we have a pretty good idea that it's the egg that came first. So in evolutionary terms, the chicken wasn't the first to lay an egg, so there were animals before the chicken which also laid eggs. But also, if you took evolution to an extreme, then you would have to conclude that at some point, one animal that wasn't a chicken gave birth to an animal that we would say is a chicken.
And how, in evolutionary terms, I don't know if you know, how long would something that maybe looks a bit like a chicken, that resembles a chicken, actually take to give birth and lay a proper chicken egg?
So, on an individual basis, it would be the same time the chicken takes to lay an egg, but for something to evolve into a different species, usually you're taking a minimum of tens of thousands of years. Possibly hundreds of thousands. And there are some animals which have been around for millions of years.
How long have humans been around? Homo sapiens?
Homo sapiens, roughly about 100,000 years. Humans are actually slightly different. So human is the genome and Homo sapien is the species. So humans have been around for about 250,000 years.
And people always say, oh, well, we aren't going to evolve anymore. Why aren't we evolving? But if something takes 100,000 years, possibly, what is there a chance that maybe humans, Homo sapiens, can evolve into something new?
There's definitely a chance. But humans are a bit different to everything else. So we've evolved to change our environment to suit us rather than adapt ourselves to the environment. So where would the human evolution go? A lot of people think we'll start adapting ourselves, possibly with technology and robots, so you start getting human-robot hybrids.
Right, let's have a look at the sciencey stories in the news this week. UK scientists will lead an expedition to the new iceberg that recently floated into the sea. It's the A16 iceberg, and we've talked about it a lot on the show. You know, it recently broke off into Antarctica, and now it's bobbing about through the water, and it's huge, 6,000 square kilometres big, and some scientists will head over there on a big boat to have a look at it really soon. Also, the sale and export of almost all ivory items will be banned from the country soon. Now, ivory is the main reason that elephants are hunted and killed so regularly in Africa. So hopefully, stopping the products coming into the UK will put a stop to much of the hunting. And finally, the Nobel Prize in Physics has been awarded to three American scientists for their work in detecting gravitational waves. They've helped investigate the ripples that were first predicted by Albert Einstein, and this has given us a much better understanding of space-time. Brilliant news that we're understanding the universe a lot better. Right, it's time for us to take a trip into the sky now with Amy Aviation.
Amy Aviation's British Aeronautics.
There are loads of places around the UK which are associated with Britain's aerospace industry. Some of them might be near to where you live. Let's spin the propeller and see where we're headed today. It's Bristol. Get ready for takeoff. Bristol is in the southwest of the UK. We're headed for Filton, a place which has a long aviation history. Airplane production began here over 100 years ago in 1910. Filton was home to the Bristol fighter plane that was used to defend the skies in the First World War. It was the Spitfire of its day. It's also where the Blenheim was made. That was a fighter used by the Royal Air Force in the early days of World War II. Filton has also been home to the manufacturer of helicopters and even satellites. But one of its most famous developments was Concorde. Concorde was a passenger jet developed by the British and French. It was launched in the 1970s and could travel at supersonic speeds. It could fly between London and New York in as little as 2.5 hours, reaching speeds of 1,300 miles an hour. This incredible plane was designed and assembled in Filton. 20 planes were built, but only 14 ever entered service. The cabin was quite small, with room for only 120 passengers. Compare that with over 600 who can fly on an Airbus A380. Concords don't fly anymore, and although in their day they used some of the most advanced technology available, they now take their place in aviation history. You can see the remaining Concords at airfields around the world, including at Filton. But the idea of supersonic travel isn't over. With advancements in materials and aerodynamics, a number of companies are looking again at supersonic passenger planes, and we may well see one within a decade. Ah, it's time for me to take to the air again. See you next time.
Amy Aviation's British Aeronautics, with support from the Royal Aeronautical Society. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Amy.
Loads more adventures through the sky with Amy Aviation for you to catch up on the Fun Kids app, on iTunes, and over at funkidslive.com. And that is the end to another episode of the show. We're back with more from the Fun Kids Science Weekly in about 7 days, probably. It's got weekly in the title. Next week, we'll actually chat to Tim Peake. He's one of 7 British people to ever have gone into space. He's a huge deal. And next week, he'll be on this show. Massive thank you, actually, while we're talking about guests, to Chris Binns, the chief engineer of Crossrail, for coming on the show earlier to tell us all about what they've been doing digging deep underground for the past 5 years. Remember, we've got loads of brilliant Fun Kids science features and episodes for free for you to listen to on iTunes, on the Fun Kids app, and on the Fun Kids website. And you can hear Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on the free Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.